For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies, count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is our very first, our inaugural Breaking Math podcast during the COVID-19 quarantine. We're a little bit behind the curve here. We have spent the last 6 weeks working on a fantastic episode, which we are bringing to you today. We'd like to acknowledge the difficulties of being in quarantine. Sophie and I are doing this episode on Zoom, and we are using our mics. We both now have mics at our own houses. So we are happy to be bringing you this episode. We do have some things related to mathematics as well as the pandemic to bring to you.
That's right. So because a lot of people don't have an idea of the sort of scale that is in question when people are talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. And so what we did is we prepared a few files to kind of show where we are in the pandemic. And the answer is we're still in the middle of it. So here is a representation of sound is measured in hertz, oscillations per second. And here is 1,000 oscillations per second, just to give you an idea of what that sounds like. And here is 500, half as many oscillations per second. So now we're going to play a sound file representing people dying in the world. For every wave is one person dying.
It is a morbid topic. I realize this. Nonetheless, this is a very real picture of what we're dealing with right now. And in order to make some meaning out of this and in order to understand it, we do have to look at the numbers. So these are sobering numbers, but they're very, very important to understand, especially for policymakers and for all of us to realize why we are in quarantine. So without further ado, this sound represents the growth in the number of deaths. And how many deaths is it per hertz, you said?
10 deaths per oscillation. So okay. that sound that you heard at the beginning, the 1,000 hertz, I'll play it again. That one would represent 10,000 people dying per second.
Wow. And of course, if you were to look at that waveform, just looking at it, it would be almost, what would you say, like exponential?
Yeah, it starts off exponential, and lately it seems to be going up and down quite a bit, which I'm thankful for, but it's still, you know, we're not out of the woods by any means. I mean, yeah, here's the world deaths. And here's the deaths in the United States, for example, which, as a lot of people around the world know, has not had an exemplary response to COVID-19. It's bungled up. It's horrible, actually. And that's not me politicizing. That's just me analyzing. But yeah, this is what it's like in the United States. Again, one oscillation is 10 deaths. And I mean, there's been 307,000 deaths in the world from this virus, at least. So, and that's only been in like 3 months, 138 days.
It's very relevant data. It's so morbid. You know what I mean? So I was contemplating what to say about that.
Yeah, I think what the message I want to get across with this is that this is a very real threat. People don't sometimes recognize how much of a threat a virus can be because it's not like a bomb, you know. It doesn't kill people like instantly in a showy way. It just kind of sneaks around and, like, you know, kills people in hospitals, and it's harder to see, but this makes it really obvious.
Okay. Yeah, so we'll just say, although that is certainly morbid data, it's very, very important data to understand, and that gives an audio representation of the increase in oscillations.
And we just happen to live in morbid times. Oh, and I sourced this data from ourworldanddata.org/coronavirus-source-data.
Without further ado, should we move on to the episode?
Absolutely. Machines, during the lifetime of anyone who is listening to this, had advanced and revolutionized the way that we live our lives. Many listening to this, for example, have lived through the rise of smartphones, 3D printing, massive advancements in lithium-ion batteries, the internet, robotics, and some have even lived through the introduction of cable TV, color television, and computers as an appliance itself. All advances in machinery, however, since the beginning of time, have one thing in common. They make what we want to do easier. One of the great tragedies of being imperfect entities, however, is that we make mistakes. Sometimes those mistakes can lead to war, famine, blood feuds, miscalculation, the punishment of the innocent, and other terrible things. It has, thus, been the goal of many, for a very long time, to come up with a system for not making these mistakes in the first place. A thinking machine, or a thinking system, which would help eliminate bias in situations. Such a fantastic machine is looking like it's becoming closer and closer to reality, especially with the advancements in artificial intelligence. What are the origins of this fantasy? What attempts have people made over time to encapsulate reason? And what is ultimately possible with automated manipulation of meaning? All of this and more on this episode of Breaking Math, episode 48, Thinking Machines.
Before we begin this episode, we'd like to plug a few things. The first thing is, of course, we do have a poster available on our Patreon page. This poster is an original product created by Sophia. It is the Tensor poster. Now, Tensor specifically, that is the... Tensors are the mathematics that are used in Einstein's general theory of relativity. This gives an overview of tensor calculus at about 30,000 feet and explains how it's integrated into the general theory of relativity. Beautiful poster. It is a beautiful poster. Now, not only can you find it on Patreon, you also can find it on our Facebook Marketplace. So be sure to check out both places.
And on the Facebook Marketplace, it's $15.15 or E to the E dollars. For a Tensor poster plus $4.50 shipping and handling, which comes out to $19.65. Yeah, we were able to lower our price significantly recently. So, yeah, that's $19.65 for a poster.
And also, on our Patreon, if you would like to support the show, we would greatly appreciate it. We have a few things for our patrons, including a tier where we deliver outlines to our episodes, as well as an early release of the episodes as well. So if you'd like to support the show and help keep us going, we would greatly appreciate that. Even if it's $1 or $2 or $5. Do we have a minimum? Is there a minimum requirement?
$1 is our lowest tier. And for that, if you want, you can get a shout out on the podcast. Be like, we'll say like, you know, like Jenny Baker likes vectors or something. If Jenny Baker donates $1 and tells us that, you know, they like vectors and wants to be on the show.
Sounds like something you'd find carved into a tree or something. Jenny Baker loves vectors or something. Maybe I'll do that. If you buy a $10 a month, if you are part of the $10 a month tree, I'll go carve your name into a tree somewhere.
I'm sure that's environmentally sound. I'm just
And totally legal as well.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And we got a Twitter at Breaking Math Pod. And as you may have heard of, because of the new bulletin that we're including it at the beginning of all of our episodes, our website is now at breakingmathpodcast.app because some pirates stole our old ones.
Correct. .app, that is .app. And there is no www. I actually made the mistake of including www. And I said, hey, it's not working. But there is none. It's just breakingmathpodcast.app. And it looks identical to our old website. For that, I'm very thankful. It even includes all of Sophia's applets, including the Hypercube, as well as the display of the Lorentz transform and the Fourier series. So I'm very
and the Game of Life on a Klein bottle.
Yeah, that as well. So let's talk a little bit about this episode as well. This episode is after literally 6 weeks of reading. I began reading an article and I began to write an outline and then I read more and more and it was absolutely a rabbit hole. So both Sophia and I have been working very, very hard on this. So what I've read, the first article I read was from the IEEE Spectrum. IEEE Spectrum is the flagship publication, which includes both a magazine and a website, of the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers. Now, the paper that I read was one of a 6-part series of articles that includes information about the history of natural language processing. It was published between October and December of 2019. The link to the series will be provided in this show notes. I highly recommend this series. It was phenomenal. It covers such beliefs about written language from the Kabbalist mystics to a belief about an alphabet of ideas and of all knowledge by Gottfried Leibniz, as well as how Claude Shannon and Andrei Markov contributed to the first language generation models, to chatbots. It even talks about implications of personal privacy and interacting with chatbots, as well as an article on Microsoft's racist chatbots. And finally, a description of an OpenAI language production machine. It's a fabulous 6-part series, so be sure to check it out.
Yeah, now, and the stuff that we'll be discussing today will be kind of like the philosophical and mathematical and actually mostly philosophical, some mathematical underpinnings of the idea of automated computation. And I think on the next episode, what we're going to talk about is ways in which this idea can be either realized or approximated.
Correct. Now, there's two things. There's two implications here. First of all, we will be talking about an idea that's, I don't want to say most recently because I don't have data on that, but most prominently forwarded by Gottfried Leibniz, this idea that there can be a universal language where all knowledge can be basically computed, kind of like a calculator. And that includes, you know, under the umbrella of all knowledge, the answer to any argument, that, you know, plain black and white facts or any innovation. He believed that such an alphabet was possible, and he believed it based on what he understood about combinatorics, about symbols, and the fact that in our current written alphabet, any word can be expressed as a certain combination of 26 letters. Fascinating idea. This is slightly different than the current idea in artificial intelligence and machine learning, where the idea is to get a computer to think more like a human brain. It's not so much about some kind of a hypothetical, universal, you know, perfect language that is the be-all and end-all of knowledge. Nonetheless, that idea was firmly believed in by Gottfried Leibniz and others, and that's, of course, what this episode is all about.
Yeah, and also it speaks to a very long tradition, starting with at least Euclid, for trying to understand the world in terms of a few sets of rules or a few symbols, a few concepts, a few precepts, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny, as I read about this idea, and as I read the articles that are currently in the notes for the episode, I sort of empathize. I understand the appeal to it. I mean, there's a long tradition, even back to Aristotle, that everything in the universe is made of a combination of certain elements. Of course, Aristotle's elements are not the elements we recognize today, but we still recognize that all matter around us is made from the same elements that we see on the periodic table in varying combinations. So yeah, it is this idea that everything around us can be expressed, you know, with some fundamental elements, you know, like these symbols that are basically the atoms for everything. So the idea,
and I also wanted to mention that over the last since Euclid's time, like there's been little nicks and like for example, squaring the circle, trisecting the angle, those were proven to be impossible with Euclidean construction, straight edge you know, compass constructions, and that was kind of in the 1800s. That's where all that started tumbling down. But that's a little foreshadowing.
Interesting. Yeah. Before we go further, let's talk a little bit about who was Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. He was a polymath. Sophia, how would you describe what a polymath is? It's not necessarily having to do with math, necessarily.
A polymath is just somebody who, because math, I think in Greek, means something like thinking or something like that, or like ability. I can't remember exactly what it means, but a polymath means somebody who's like very, very skilled or very gifted in multiple areas. So
yes,
it's like, mm-hmm. It's like, you know, they're not just good at math, but they're good at, you know, like art and gymnastics and
music, like, or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Bit of a Renaissance person. And Leibniz most certainly was a polymath. He was definitely a Renaissance man. He was a fantastic inventor. Now, he was a contemporary of Isaac Newton, and he is He is credited as being the co-inventor of calculus along with Isaac Newton. That is a huge, huge deal. In fact, I believe in my studies, I more often than not use Leibniz's notation for calculus and not Newton's. So
Newton's notation is only pretty much used in engineering in certain contexts, right? The X with the dot above it to mean...
Yes. Now that I think about it, all of the calculus classes I took, Calc 1, Calc 2, Calc 3, all of that used Leibniz's notation. The only Newtonian notation I used was in my controls class. Goodness. Wow.
I remember that class. I also know that Leibniz tried to put things in terms of limits a lot more rigidly and stuff than Newton. There's like a little bit of difference in their philosophy, and they invented calculus within a year of one another, and they argued about it, I believe, to their deaths or something. I don't actually know if they argued about it or if other people did, but...
Yeah. So Leibniz's idea that we're talking about in this episode, this universal language, this actually has roots in his dissertation. He did a dissertation called On the Combinatorial Art. Okay, so it was probably a Latin version of that, but it meant on the combinatorial art when he was about 20...
And it would have been Latin because this is 1666 when he was 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He lived from 1646 to 1716.
Okay, yeah. Now, in this dissertation, as well as in multiple later works, he wrote about his belief that through the art of combinations, or the combinatorial art, this art would involve combining symbols of human ideas using certain rules and arrive at all knowledge. And he said repeatedly that there would be no sense in having any argument whatsoever whenever two people would find themselves arguing, whether they're geniuses or your average people of average intelligence, they'd just stop and say, let us calculate. And they would use this combinatorial language and figure out in unambiguous black and white terms who was right.
Exactly. And now, while that's a beautiful idea, we do need to acknowledge a little early on that that what Leibniz is describing almost exactly, you know, a finite alphabet of symbols, some rules that manipulate those symbols logically. He's describing an axiomatic system in basically before they became popular in the 1800s. He's very, very ahead of his time. It looks like he did this more philosophically than... really do any notation, almost in the same way that Thomas Aquinas came up with a few calculus concepts before, you know, calculus kind of thing.
No, I get what you're saying. Now, before we continue, as an interesting exercise for our listeners, as I read this, I thought, something's not right about this. You know, one of the things to argue about this, which we'll get into later, is, okay, give me an example. Give me a couple of elemental symbols that you suggest, you know, are used, and some rules to describe their relationships. You know, give me something concrete that I can actually see what you're talking about and say, oh, wow, yeah, that's brilliant, you know. But as you said, the key word here is axioms. So, you know, before we talk about the limits of axioms, which we've talked about many times on this show, I'm curious what our listener might think is wrong or problematic with Leibniz's idea at this time. Sophia, you mentioned axioms as an axiomatic system. What might be wrong with it?
Well, as we've talked about on the show before, there's a thing that we know about axiomatic systems that was proven by Kurt Gödel in the early 20th century.
Girdle.
That basically, if an axiomatic system is trying to represent like a logic, if it's complex enough to really to represent the operations of logic, then the axiomatic system will either be incomplete, meaning that truths can be expressed within that system that cannot be proven within the system, or it will be inconsistent, meaning that there will be contradictions, and inconsistent systems are essentially useless.
Correct. Yes. So you'll either have contradicting statements, or you will have axioms that cannot be proven. Now,
axioms that can be proven, but theorems, because an axiom is assumed to be true.
Okay. Oh, very good. Very good. Yes. Great. Good to have proper definitions and proper pronunciations. It was pointed out to us at one point from a great fan of ours that we are maybe mispronouncing his name. It is Kurt Gödel, not Kurt Gödel. And that's
even though, I mean, he said it's Gödel. I mean, it's a little closer, but I mean, it would actually be Gödel. Like, it's like almost like it's like you make almost like a shape, but then you kind of make an E like shape that? With your mouth. It's kind of like, you know, the French like it's like one of those vowels that doesn't exist in English.
Okay.
Yeah, girdle.
Man, I thought I had a rhyme there, like Kurt Girdle, like a turtle. I don't know. I thought but it's not. As you said, I'm having difficulty pronouncing it. And that's another thing with learning other languages and dialects. It's better to learn it when you're younger because that's so much harder to learn the correct pronunciation when you're older. Now, Leibniz was really stoked on this idea. Like he would try to sell it to everybody, you know. He thought that his language would be a way of discovering or producing new knowledge and new inventions simply through combining the fundamental symbols of the language, the elements or letters according to certain rules. Leibniz referred to his idea as the mother of all inventions, which would lead to, and I'm quoting him, the discovery of all things. Now, I do want to point out where I got those quotes from. You can find them on there's a couple of articles on Leibniz. One of my favorite articles was actually the Wikipedia page, which was the information in it was corroborated in every article I read. The Wikipedia page is called, what's it called?
Which
one? I'm gonna search the name of the Wikipedia page. It's called like Characteristica Universalis, which is again the name of the idea put forth in his dissertation. And that page is a thorough description of his idea as well as the problems of it. So I highly suggest any interested readers to check it out. Now I want to talk a little bit more about Leibniz and his ideas. Unless Sophia, would you like to read this bullet point?
Well, I mean, So basically, I think that what's important to know is the sort of philosophical and mathematical environment that Leibniz was around that would lead him to these ideas. Because, okay. I mean, he thought that they could be expressed as geometry and computed, and that a machine could be built upon these principles since they are geometric, such that any question input into it would be either true or false. It would be a perfect truth machine, as we already discussed, is impossible, but... and I want to bring something up really quick before we continue about that. Just because it's impossible for something to be a truth machine for all truth does not mean that it's impossible for a machine to be a truth machine for a great deal of truth, an incredible amount of truth. Like, there's no limit to how much truth that you could find using an axiomatic system. It's just not ever going to be infinite.
So perfection is impossible. And in a way, here's the thing. Quick little point of argument here. Is that actually a good thing? Because that means that we will never have the full answer, and there will always be reason to strive more for a better understanding. So that could be a good thing in fact, you know, depending on how you...
Well, I think it's a good thing specifically because, I don't think we know the reason why we like to know things yet. I don't think we know the evolutionary reason for that explicitly, especially because evolution is kind of confounded by mimetic evolution. But we'll probably bring that up on another episode where we go a little bit nuts.
Yeah, that's a fascinating topic. I think Richard Dawkins is most famous for his work on mimetic evolution
The selfish gene has a lot of mention of that in it. The selfish gene is about how DNA exists in the interest of its own replication. Basically creatures are a byproduct of that.
Interesting stuff. So in the early days, grammar and logic were considered very closely related subjects. Good grammar, the theory went, meant that you would be a logical thinker. Latin, in fact, was seen as the high standard of organized thought, and Leibniz himself, as well as many others, used Latin in their writing.
And this, of course, it's a byproduct of Roman colonialism, basically.
Right. In fact, didn't they have something called in terms of education, a body of work called the Trivium, and it was included in the Trivium?
The Trivium was what you would I think it was like your first year as a liberal arts student in the Middle Ages, like kind of like your core requisites. You'd have to know grammar, which is considered a type of knowledge, logic, which is considered the mechanics of thought, which, you know, needed grammar, and rhetoric, using logic and grammar to convince. So basically grammar, logic, and rhetoric were the first things you studied. And then the Quadrivium came around. And the Quadrivium is actually later in date than the Trivium, and the name Quadrivium came before Trivium, but the Quadrivium was arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, which were considered four different types of number. Arithmetic was manipulating numbers themselves. Geometry was manipulating numbers in space. Music was representing manipulating numbers in time. And astronomy was representing numbers in space and time because, you know, physics hadn't been invented yet.
Wow. The way you describe that is just beautiful. Like, I've never heard that description before. It definitely has this elegance to it, almost like the body of all knowledge as you are approaching, you know, divine knowledge almost. At least, you know, I can see how one might think that at least.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was not really until like the, like, 1800s, really, that people started thinking, oh, wait, maybe logic is incomplete, or maybe we can't just coast on this idea that we'll figure out everything.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, so even things like music, you know, they can be represented and communicated symbolically. That's how we've got music notation. So just like a language, there is a way of noting, of communicating music. And, you know, any musician can write using standard music notation and give it to any other musician who understands that language, and then they can play the same sheet of music. So I definitely understand this appeal of this universal language.
Yeah, and music notation actually dates back to the time of the first Renaissance in Europe, which was kind of between, like, you know, the 1100s and 1300s, basically. Yes. Right before, like, you know, the first plague. Mm-hmm. But there's this guy who is named Ramon Llull. Who is a philosopher, logician, and mystic. He was also a mathematician, polymath, philosopher, and a Franciscan tertiary. And he was from the Kingdom of Mallorca.
And 13th century, is that right? 13th, 14th century?
Yeah, 12th okay. to 1300, 13th, 14th
so
century.
He came far before Leibniz. In fact, Leibniz, I believe, was very, very much influenced by, I'm going to work on his pronunciation, Ramon Llull, or I can't.
Llull.
Llull, almost. Okay, so it's
there we go.
His last name, and again, forgive me with my my limited pronunciation ability here. His last name is L-L-U-L-L, and it's not Lull, it's Llull. Like, it's the traditionally Spanish pronunciation of two L's, which is more like a Y.
Yeah, it's like almost a Y, basically, yeah.
Yes. So he had an idea that was very similar to Leibniz, and it was centuries before Leibniz. So as you had said, he was from the Kingdom of Mallorca. Is that how you say it?
Mallorca, yeah.
Can we edit that out? All of my...
Wait, not me Mallorca. Wait, is that Mallorca or Mallorca? Hold on.
Mallorca.
Because
okay.
I know there's some weird pronunciation changes in the... Yeah, Mallorca.
Okay. So he was from the Kingdom of Mallorca from the 13th and 14th centuries, as I said earlier, and he had a desire to come up with a way of proving the truth of Christianity, again, just like a mathematical proof, with irrefutable logic. Now,
yeah, and this is also an interest to a lot of people at the time. I believe that Occam, fame of Occam's razor, and Thomas Aquinas were almost contemporaries of this person, and they had very similar goals, because Christianity was considered, like, assumed. It wasn't like anybody's arguing against it. They're like, okay, this is here, and now what?
Yes. And also, with respect to who thought of the original idea, it's almost like everything has been done under the sun, because, in fact, Llull was inspired from others who came before him. He was inspired by Jewish Kabbalists who used a system of combinatorics, which used the Hebrew alphabet in certain combination to supposedly reveal divine knowledge. There is record, in fact, you can read about this in the papers from the IEEE Spectrum paper. I think their very first paper from back in October on this talks about some Jewish Kabbalists who believed that if you played with letters, it was possible to conjure a demon. And there were rumors.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
of Jewish Kabbalists who would conjure a demon who would become a house servant if they really understood what they were doing. There were also stories of Jewish Kabbalists who did not understand what they were doing.
You ain't never had a friend like me.
And they played with letters and they'd conjure a spirit or a demon who would do horrible things. So again, I want to thank the IEEE Spectrum publication for that information. That was very, very interesting. So, you know, this whole idea of combining letters and coming up with things, this goes back a long ways. Now with
it's kind
Ramon,
of funny that a lot of modern Kabbalists they're the people who work on like the Bible code stuff, which is like basically a way of, like, I mean, it's statistically, like, you know, unsound and stuff, but it's kind of an interesting thing to like,
yes,
just look at as like a fascinating thing. And also the movie Pi by Darren Aronofsky in 1995, I believe, has a lot of these themes in it, and of the whole Hebrew alphabet being used as a way to generate truth. And honestly, I think that that movie, like, it's kind of I recommend it.
It's a great movie. Yes. Now, in fact, if you guys want to go down another rabbit hole, you can, as you said, Google search the Bible code. There are two books in the Bible code, and they came out, I want to say, in the last 20 years, and that's exactly what it's about. It's about making computers that supposedly decipher hidden information in the Bible, or in the Bibles, in the Bible. That's literally what the Bible code is about. I recommend you read the Wikipedia page on it. You can also read the criticisms of it as well. It's fascinating. But again, it uses this whole idea of a perfect language and hidden information and prophecy, which
we're
not.
See, this is a very ancient idea. And I mean, oracle bones in China, which is the origin of the Chinese language, are doing this as well.
Kind of the same thing as astrology or reading tea leaves. It's looking for patterns in random information and sort of, I want to say, reading meaning into it in many cases. So obviously we are not believers in this here, full disclosure. Hope we haven't defended anybody. Well, that's not really true, but you know, we're just being true to ourselves here. It's interesting stuff to look into. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about Ramon Llull. So again, he set out to prove the truth of Christianity using combinatorics and logic and some kind of a perfect symbolic alphabet. He tried to create a tool to convert people to the Christian faith, and he actually went so far as to propose 18 fundamental general principles. Now, I'm going to read these here in a second. I want to say that again. He had 18 fundamental general principles, kind of like how, you know, we've got 26 letters of the alphabet.
Or like,
and
also it's along kind of like the same, if you know about like Ben Franklin's 13 virtues, things like that.
Yeah, 13 virtues or the 7 deadly sins. So let's take a look at these 18 fundamental general principles and think, you know, can we describe everything in our universe using these? You know, well, even if we don't think so, he certainly did. The 18, goodness, greatness, eternity, I'm going to go faster, power, wisdom, will, virtue, truth, glory, difference, concordance, contrariety, how is that different than difference? I don't know. Beginning, middle, end, majority, equality, and minority. Whew, my goodness. So I feel like if this were a game of Dungeons and Dragons and you were talking about people, that would be the stats list. And you'd have a finite amount of points to put for each of those stats. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, like, how do you differentiate goodness from greatness from power?
Yeah. And also there's like the language barrier and like the time barrier and like, you know.
Yes. Yeah. So again, he made a concerted effort. I mean, we even do that now with trying to, you know, we've got the laws of physics, you know, and the fundamental constants of the universe. So, we're all trying to do the same thing here. So I really can't judge him on that one. But still, it's like, you know, with a 20th century understanding, 21st century understanding, we certainly look at this and think, how could he do anything with it? But
yeah, and the Pythagoreans had a table of opposites that they used in a similar way, too. And that was the infinite and finite, odd and even, one and many, right and left, rest and motion, straight and crooked, light and darkness, good and evil, square and oblong. So it follows a very long intellectual tradition.
Wow. Yeah. You're right. In fact, it even goes back to Euclid and the elements. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. At least that. I mean, yeah, I think Pythagoras predates Euclid even. But yeah, so, definitely even before that, I think.
And
but,
just for some foreshadowing here, you know, again, we've already talked about this, but it bears repeating. What did Gödel say about every and all system of axioms and attempts at describing everything? It doesn't work. Gödel's incompleteness theorem, any system that is sufficiently complex and can refer to itself will either have statements that are that you cannot prove are true, or you will have contradicting statements. So, so you know, we're pretty much doomed to incompleteness here.
Yeah, or we are always assured work as mathematicians.
Yes, we're always assured work. That's the optimistic way of looking at it. I like that. Now, Ramon Llull actually invented a machine called a volvel. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It was a circular paper mechanism made up of small concentric circles. And on these circles were written the symbols that represented the various aspects of God. Interesting. So I'd like to see a picture of this device. I did not see any images or any diagrams of this device.
Yeah, I couldn't
device,
really find this anywhere. I tried looking for a while. I think I would have to probably go to the library to find it.
Yeah. The only thing I'm thinking of is, you know, those little things you make in elementary school, those little paper fortune tellers. I mean,
I saw a picture of a few volvels from the time. And I mean, they're like little calculating things, like, you know, like little pieces of paper that you slide over one another. And what's cool is that they last a really long time because we still have these little like paper machines like from like the medieval times.
That's cool. Now, again, although we don't have a diagram of the actual device itself, we do have some more descriptions. And apparently, Llull believed that by spinning the volvel in certain ways, he could bring the symbols into certain combinations and he'd reveal aspects of God. Leibniz was very, very impressed by Llull's paper machine. And he proposed that such a system would require three things. Number one, an alphabet of human thought, which I think that Ramon Llull also believed in terms of the symbols, at least. So they were on the same wavelength with that. Leibniz also believed that we would need a list of logical rules for their valid combination and recombination, and finally, a mechanism that would carry out the logical operations on the symbols quickly and accurately, basically like a modern-day computer, or something that he would imagine would be like a computer in his day.
I mean, I understand the desire to do this kind of thing. I mean, when I was like 15 or so, I thought that it would be possible to come up with two base ideas and then use comparisons between them to create any thought. So like I thought it'd be like, you know, like comparisons like if this is to this as that is to that kind of thing.
Interesting. So you had some commonalities there with Leibniz and with Ramon Llull.
I think this just speaks to the universal irresistibility of this idea.
Yes. This episode is all about an imaginary machine envisioned by Gottfried Leibniz that could use symbols and permutations to come up with any creative idea or to solve any human argument with perfect logic. Such an idea, we now know, is not actually possible. However, it certainly is possible to program a computer to function more like a human brain and to teach itself new things. This is done through something called an artificial neural network. To that end, our wonderful partner, Brilliant, has a course called Introduction to Neural Networks that will teach you the fundamentals of this amazing concept. I love how this course covers such essential questions as, do you have to be living to be learning? And why are neural networks needed? Or why is it that some things just cannot be programmed? Also, how does one create a neural network? How can one teach a computer to teach itself? To support your education in math and computer science, go to www.brilliant.org/breakingmath and sign up for free. The first 200 Breaking Math listeners can get 20% off the annual subscription, which we have been using. And now, back to the episode. Now, as a quick aside, there's something that I'd like to mention real quick before we continue. This episode that we're doing right now is one that continues a theme in the Breaking Math podcast, and that is one that bridges the gap between mathematics, which involves calculation, and written and spoken language, which involve, and now both of these involve qualitative and quantitative factors, and they both share the property that they both approximate some idea of truth or reality, such as mathematical truth or human thought. and rules for manipulating those symbols, like grammar. Both are ubiquitous in the human experience. We wish to briefly mention some of the prior episodes in this podcast that have touched on the themes and that somehow overlap between mathematics and language. Three years ago, we had an episode, episode 6, that was called Word. This episode was an introduction to the field of linguistics itself and of the evolution of human language. It was pretty light on math, but it did touch on the ways in which language can be analyzed and described using mathematics. We then had episode 24, which is called Language and Entropy. In this episode, we discussed a mathematical model of spoken language using concepts of Claude Shannon's communication and information theory.
Which I think dates back to 1946. He was engineer at Bell Labs.
That's right. Yeah, so this is a very recent thing. Very recent thing, in fact. And this model that we discussed in this episode, it uses these ideas, things like noise and entropy, in order to propose a mathematical model of spoken language between a sender and a receiver. This episode was much more math-heavy, but it does get to some of the main tenets of information theory pretty quickly and accessibly. So
yeah, not just us, and also I forgot to put in the outline, not just spoken language, but also just communication itself, like how it could even be applied to the internet, this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. So I really liked that paper that we talked about in the episode, because it got into the rigorous mathematics of communication and, you know, used real examples in a model language. So that's what we try to do. We try to describe phenomena in real life with math, and it's a doozy trying to do it with language. Now, I must say, this model language was very, very small. Do you remember how many letters and how many words it had? It was like under 20, right?
Let's see. For which one?
For in episode 24 in Language and Entropy, in this paper, it had a proposed very, very small language that it used as an example. And it had a very...
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. No, yeah, it has several of those. I mean, one of the languages is just is binary. The simplest one is just binary.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's very, very hard to describe language itself mathematically, because there's so much cultural nuance and so much prior knowledge that you need. So very, very hard thing to do, but they try to do
it. The cool thing about this kind of thing, though, is that you could literally measure like how many bits humans talk about, you know, per like second and stuff like that. Check out the episode. It's a pretty good one.
Yes, absolutely. So anyways, back to Leibniz. Yeah, he was interesting. He thought very, very highly of his little idea. Do you want to read one of the quotes?
And of himself and his peers. He was what we would call today as a total classist.
Absolutely.
He said, "It is beneath the dignity of excellent men to waste their time in calculation when any peasant could do this work just as accurately with the aid of a machine." So, I mean, like, he just sounds... I mean, he could have said that differently, but...
Oh, yeah, total classist. Wow. Interesting. Now, speaking of machines, we also have a couple of episodes on calculating machines. Episode 4 of the Breaking Math Podcast is called Digital Evolution. We actually talk about the evolution of computing hardware, everything from the abacus to some ancient Greek mechanisms of calculation.
Antikythera, yeah.
Yeah, we also had the Pascaline, which was, it wasn't even powered by electricity. It was just a little box with, you know, some cranks and stuff.
It added and subtracted.
Yes. And then we also get a little bit into Shannon's information theory and electronic computers. So we do talk a lot about the evolution of computing hardware and why it is what it is today. It is worth noting that Leibniz himself designed some computing hardware, even though he never designed a language. He didn't design what he was talking about. He did design a mathematical calculator, and I think it was called the Stepped Reckoner. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we actually talked about that in episode 4, too. But it was the first calculating machine. It was built over a period of 22 years, from 1694 to 1672. So it would have been like...
Wait, that's backward. You mean, are those dates backwards?
Oh, yeah, they must be backwards.
But he did it backwards in time. So 1672 to 1694.
Yeah, it cost 24,000 thaler. And what a thaler is a pretty heavy little gold coin. So it he spent basically $2,000, a little over $2,000 in today's USA money per day, $763,000 per year, or $16.8 million on this project in today's money. And that's based on craftsman's wages and grams of silver per day and a couple of other calculations. We'll probably put those up on the Facebook side.
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money put in.
Yeah, even conservatively estimating, it's at least $9 million, like very conservatively.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
But the machine that he made with this, like, millions and millions of dollars is about the size of a desk, and it adds, subtracts, multiplies, and divides. And I believe he made two of them.
Yeah.
So this Leibniz realized, you know, it could do four simple operations, but it took a very long time. And he got a little bit more sober in his later years. Basically, he wrote something basically saying that he knew it wouldn't be within his lifetime that the hardware would exist to carry out his ideas. And he's very right. Electronic computers wouldn't come about until the 1930s or 1920s.
So he very much had to learn the hard way, which is oftentimes, well, sometimes it's the best way. I don't know, but he certainly got a lot more cynical in his later years about his idea as a whole. He may have still believed in it, but he knew that it would be a lot harder than he had envisioned originally. Now, reading the Wikipedia page on his idea, again, it's the Wikipedia page titled Characteristica Universalis, and I know I'm not pronouncing that correctly. I'm aware of that. But that page includes a couple of drawings from Leibniz that you know, for some proposed, I want to say letters or symbols in this alphabet that he was imagining. These symbols are, how do I describe them? They're available to see on the Wikipedia page. They're sort of like coins, or sort of like, what do you call the symbol for, like, you know, like if a family has a shield with symbols on it?
Oh, crest.
A crest. Yes, exactly. It's very similar to a crest. What Aristotle had written are four crests for the four elements: earth, fire, water, and air. And you know, there is a drawn symbol, kind of like a hieroglyphic, as well as some words describing their relationship. Now, you can't really do anything with it. There's no description of combinations or you know, I mean, like, for now, literally, it's essentially a crest. But this got me thinking that, you know, he tried to have information in a symbol, and it got me thinking about Shannon's information theory. So Leibniz was not aware of Shannon. He was, you know, 300 years before Shannon, and he didn't think about the ideas that Shannon was aware of, like, what is the smallest unit of information? You know, basically, it's a bit. It's a one or a zero.
I want to bring up, though, that you can technically transmit a part of a bit if you have more than one symbol per, like, let's say if you have a trinary system, which is 0, 1, and 2, but okay, because of the way that you're transmitting it, you represent each one with two characters. So, like, 0 could be ABAC or CA, 1 could be BCBA or AB, and 2 could be CA, CB, or BC. Basically, you would get log 2 of 3 half bits, which is like 0.585 bits is what you'd be able to send with the first symbol, no matter what. So it's just kind of an interesting aside that bits can be divided and stuff like that, but you have to do little funny things like that.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I guess what I was thinking about was looking at all of the symbols. I thought about what is the smallest, you know, what's the smallest way to meaningfully communicate information. And yeah, as you said, it does get into bits, but not only that, you do have to have symbols for things, which means that you have to know what those symbols stand for. You know what I mean? And basically that's all of communication theory as we have it right now. So
yeah, because the
think
meaning itself is something that really hasn't been described well by anyone. Even people in computer science, artificial intelligence are still coming up with, in their infancy, things for meaning representation. I mean, it kind of started with stuff in the 60s with Lisp, but it's going very, not slowly, but it's just something that, you know, we've never had a philosophical underpinning for.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
In the example that I gave, if somebody sends a B, you know, it's either a 1 or a 2, but you know it's not a 0. So since you've restricted it to 2 out of 3 options, you take the inverse of that, which is 3 halves, and you take log base 2 of that show the number of bits that you have. And then for the next symbol, because it's resolving it, you send the remaining 0.415 or so bits.
Yeah. So I'm curious then how all of this knowledge about information theory and bits, how all of that would influence Leibniz and his own design of his alphabet, or would it? I don't know.
I'm guessing it would, at least to give him some, like, maybe a foothold on, like, how to, like, really analyze language and stuff like that, because he was just kind of going about it blind. I mean, he went to the four elements. He was that esoteric about it.
Yeah, and again, he was as wrong. Is it fair to say that he was as wrong as Aristotle was about the elements in of themselves, in the sense that the elements are most certainly not the four that he thought they were? And,
yeah, I mean, I think that those are just like philosophical elements that he meant. Like, I don't think he literally believed in actually, he might have. He was during the period where people still believed in that.
You know, you're right. It's very possible that he actually did believe in the elements.
Because I know Newton, who's a contemporary, was an alchemist as well.
Yeah, that's right. I was aware of this. I was aware of that. Yep. Interesting. Yeah, so one can have a very good grasp intuitively on you know, fundamental rules of physics, and at the same time be completely wrong when it comes to things like, as you said earlier, alchemy, that are a little more complex and certainly boiled down to the physics, but they're still appealing. You know, like it's fool's gold. It's this it's this idea where you can still be wrong about things, even if you understand the fundamentals very, very well. And now we're going to talk about Kurt Gödel, whose work is essentially the coup de grace, which explains why none of these systems of mathematics or of communication will ever be complete. By their nature, they are forever incomplete.
And we talk a lot about that on episode 22, Incomplete, which is about Gödel as your Bach, which is a book, chapter 4 of it. But also we talk a lot about the incompleteness theorem. It was published in 1931. He himself lived from 1906 to 1978. And we talked about it already, that it proves that for any sufficiently complex system, there's going to be either incomplete, meaning that I can't prove everything, or it'll be inconsistent, meaning that it'll say contradictory things and basically be useless. Because if two things contradict one another logically and they're in the same system, you can prove anything to be true or false, no matter what it is.
Correct. Yes. And my thinking as I was reading about Leibniz's idea here is that this in of itself, more than anything else, should prove why Leibniz's idea is forever impossible. This I would have thought would have been the best description. If you were to have a conversation with Leibniz and explain to him why his idea wouldn't work, I would start with Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Now, I read something that absolutely blew my mind. On the Wikipedia page that I continuously talk about on this episode, again, it's the page Characteristica Universalis, at the very bottom of it, there's a discussion on Gödel. And to my great surprise, I found out that Gödel was, in fact, a conspiracy theorist about this issue. He not only believed that Leibniz's idea would work, but he also believed that academics and scholars the world over had swept away Leibniz's notes on this idea because of their absolute power.
Yeah, because I mean, he would find like compilations of Leibniz's work, and just because of some like weird like publishing quirks, like a lot of his talks about the Characteristica Universalis were removed. And by the way, by what I understand, Gödel did not think that Leibniz's idea of everything being provable was possible, but I know he did believe that meaning representation was something that he had a major handle on, and that was being repressed by the institutions at the time.
Yeah, he absolutely believed that this knowledge was being repressed by the institutions. This was wild. So I'm very curious then, this is not what I thought would happen. So when I first read this, I was taken aback because I thought, well, do I not understand Gödel's incompleteness theorem as well as I thought I did? Or do I not understand what Leibniz was thinking? Does Gödel have an understanding about what Leibniz was trying to do that I don't understand? All of these questions went through my mind, and I spent a long time. That's actually part of the reason why this episode has been delayed. I've been trying to get a handle on how many times have I said Gödel now? Old habits die hard. That's going to be fun to edit, isn't it? Let's just keep all the pronunciations of Gödel in there. My apologies. Kurt Gödel.
Oh, yeah. Technically, the way that the vowels pronounce is if you make an sound, but then you round out your lips without changing the position of your tongue, that's the vowel. So it's like Gödel.
Good. Yeah, it's hard to do. I'm gonna have to really work on that.
Try it real quick though. It's fun.
Gödel. Is that it?
Yeah, go eh, and then slowly round your lips without moving your tongue or teeth. So
good old. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, good.
It's good exercise. Good exercise. I will get it yet. I just know in this episode I've said Godel so many times it's not even funny.
Well, just for that, I'll say Geidel.
Geidel. Yeah. Good. Okay, very good. So I just found that interesting, and it made me wonder if Kurt Gödel understood something, or Gödel, if Kurt Gödel, that's the best I can do. If he understood something about Leibniz's ideas that I did not understand, you know what I mean? Because he really believed that there was something more substantial created. I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
and know. Also, there is a very interesting philosophical difference between representation of truth and representation of meaning. And yes. I know that Gödel, I mean, he definitely would have been thinking a lot about that with this, especially because he was very adamant with Hilbert. Hilbert had a similar idea. He wanted to make a game. He called it the math game or something like that, which would basically be an automated process for solving everything eventually. Oh. And that was something that Gödel kept disproving.
Yeah. Wow. So this is an interesting point in this podcast. We had mentioned this previously, but up until this point, we've been talking about this idea of a universal language, which through various combinatorics of some symbols as well as a set of rules, all knowledge could be arrived at. We've also talked about some of the problems with that and why it is, to the best of our knowledge, pure fantasy. In fact, I'm quite confident saying it is pure fantasy. Now, there are some things that do exist, and we'd like to talk about those. Things like chatbots, which, although they are not a perfect universal language, they are something that are built to try to approximate the human language, a noble and puzzling endeavor in of itself.
Transition. Yeah, and that's definitely, and we're going to talk about that next time, is how has computing and things like that really tried to realize these ancient desires to automate thought? How have they drawn upon, Leibniz and all the people before them? How does that change the work? How has it changed the environment that creates the work, et cetera?
And that's definitely two separate questions. The first question being, can a perfect universal language be made, or can a machine be made to think and act like a human? Two different questions, and there is not a solid answer to either one of them. But again, there is the materialist assumption of, well, if we are just machines fundamentally, and I realize that is the materialist assumption, but that would say logically one would think it's possible to make a machine to act like we do. That is a question that we continue, that the human race, or sorry, that the that humankind continues to chase after.
Although the ideal example of a perfectly thinking machine is something that has been proven to be fantasy, the fact remains that humans are thinking machines themselves. So an imperfect problem solver or thinking machine cannot then, by the same argument, be necessarily disallowed. And research over the past 70 years in artificial intelligence has revealed the complexity of these processes, along with a dazzling array of techniques to go along with them. All of this and more on the next episode of Breaking Math. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Gabriel.
And this has been Breaking Math. So we're at http://breakingmathpodcast.app. You don't have to put the HTTP, but just make sure you don't put a www and you'll be good.
All right. This has been a lot of fun. I'm glad to be back.
Oh, yeah. Same. I'm so glad everything is COVID threw me for a loop, a lot of turbulence in how I organized stuff, but back online.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.